Om Parthaya Parivartitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Ritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamani Sampadhani Bhagavad Gita Bhagavad Vishnim.
Okay, now verse 23.
Ya evam deti purusham prakritim cha gunasaha prakritim cha gunasaha sarvatha vartamanopi sarvatha vartamanopi nasabhuyo bhijayate nasabhuyo bhijayate yaha evam deti purusham prakritim cha gunaihi saha sarvatha vartamanaha api na saha bhuyaha abhijayate. So having spent quite a while unfolding really the nature of the purusha and the prakriti, he says, yaha evam veti, the one who in this manner, eva means in this manner, means in the way that it's been unfolded in this chapter, he who in this manner, veti, knows the purusha and the prakriti, prakritimcha, purusham, purusham, prakritimcha, gunaihi saha, together with their gunas, that person, I'll redefine these words in a minute for now, purusham, prakriti, and the gunas. So the one who knows the purusha and the prakriti together, along with saha, along with the gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, sarvata, vartamanaha api, even though being engaged, vartamana is a present participle, meaning being engaged or existing within vyavahara, within this empirical reality, sarvata, in many, many different ways, even though that person can be engaged in the world in many different ways, many different stages of life, many different dharmas, many different responsibilities, even though that being the case, saha bhuyaha abhijayate, that person who knows the purusha and prakriti in the way that as it's been unfolded, that person is not born again. Abhijayate, he does not take a birth again. Okay? So here, let's just review a little bit. The purusha is Brahman. Purusha is the pratyagatma, that innermost conscious being, yourself, which is the self in all beings. The purusha is really Brahman. It means the conscious being that you are, the recognition that conscious being, that innermost self that you are, is in fact the self that is the self of all beings, all human beings, all animals, all plants. In fact, that purusha is the conscious being, which is the self of the whole creation, the self of Ishwara, the self of God. So the whole Vedanta, all of the Upanishads, the vision of the Vedanta really is that the conscious being that you are, this me, this conscious being that you are, is the self, not is not like the self, but is the self of all beings, is the self of the entire creation. And in fact, it's not only the self of the entire creation, but is the sat-chit. It is the existence, the actual being which the entire creation enjoys, and it is also the consciousness, the knownness, which the entire creation enjoys. So what that means is if the conscious being, which is myself, this conscious section that is my being, is the being of the whole creation, is the self of the whole creation, then the whole creation, everything that is within manifest duality, that we call as Ishwara, as the Lord, as God. Because if it was just the creation, if it was just and like an inert creation or Mother Nature, we wouldn't necessarily call Mother Nature God. why we would call Mother Nature God is only if Mother Nature, this creation, is a conscious being. And if a whole, everything that exists within this manifest creation on all levels enjoys for itself, if it has a self, and that self is the conscious being, is its very truth, then this creation is no longer an inert creation. It's one God that is omniscient. All of these words that in all the different religions of the world, God is omniscient, omnipotent, the creator. You know, when we talk, we can apply all of those words here in Vedanta, but we have to understand that within Vedanta, that omniscience is because the whole manifest creation is like an infinite mind. The whole manifest creation is known, just like every thought in your mind is known. If you have a dream, that dream is known. If you have an imagination, that imagination is known. Whatever thought modification you have in your mind, the whole thought is known. There's not one part of a thought that is away from awareness. It's not like the left side of the thought has more awareness than the right side of the thought. And if you have a perception, like now with my sense organs, with my eyes, I'm perceiving this room, which is three-dimensional perception. But there is no part of this three-dimensional perception that is away from conscious being. The whole perception exists, and the whole perception is known. And it's not like the knownness of the painting on the wall is farther away from consciousness than the knownness of this body. Right? Because both are known. It's not that the painting is known, the body is known, the rug is known, the space is known. Everything that exists in dimensional reality equally enjoys being. It is, it is, it is, it is. And it equally enjoys knownness. Knownness is the synonym here for consciousness. For something to be known can't be away from consciousness. It's not like you're the conscious being and all of these things are away from consciousness, because if there was some sort of a chasm there, a gap, then you would only go up to the gap. Right? If there's a consciousness gap, how are you going to jump over it? You can't. It'll hit a dead end right there. So, in fact, all the experience that you have is in consciousness. The consciousness we call the Purusha. The consciousness which I enjoy as me, the consciousness which the whole creation enjoys, that in fact is the Purusha. Purusha, if we translate it, it means a person. A man is a Purusha. If you go into the etymology of it, though, it's the one in abiding, lying down, abiding, resting in the puri, in the city. The city is often used as a metaphor for the physical body because the city has gates that you can enter. You enter through the sense organs and you have gates of evacuation also. You can come in and go out, come in and go out. So it's likened to a city. So the Purusha, the consciousness, conscious being that is me, is the one abiding in this, you know, five-gated or eight-gated city called the Puri. Purusha also means the one who is Purna, who is absolutely full, full and complete. So the Satchit Ananda, the self that is the very being of everything that is Purna. Purna comes from the root Kriya, to feel. So that which is absolutely full, there's no place else for it to go. It's infinite. And so the conscious being that you are, once it's recognized as the self of all beings, and in fact the Satchit, the conscious existence, the very being that all beings enjoy, then that Purusha really becomes the self of everything, the reality, becomes the reality of everything. So now, there's something that has to happen here. So he says, the one who knows the Purusha in this way, that the conscious being that I am is the self of all beings, is the very self of the whole creation, who knows the Purusha in this way, and who knows the Prakriti together with all of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. So here, the Prakriti is a synonym for Maya. Maya is comprised of sattva, rajas, and tamas. Maya is, when we say Maya, what we're talking about is all objectifiable reality. Everything that I perceive through sense perception, any mental type of cognition, anything in this creation which is capable of objectification. All of that has for its material cause what we call Maya. Maya is comprised of sattva, rajas, and tamas. It's like a three braids. With a sattva, if we were to break Maya up, we break it into three principles. The sattva, what reflects consciousness, rajas, which is responsible for all activity, tamas, which is responsible for nama rupa, for name and form. And so why they do this with Maya, they say sattva, rajas, and tamas, is it's just a way of making huge, broad strokes for everything that exists in the creation, the intelligence, principle, your sense organs, mind, you know, the whole creation is an infinite mind. All of the names and forms that exist, all of the activity, all of the motion, you know, so the energy. So the sattva, rajas, and tamas are just three broad strokes of everything that can, in which you can categorize all of our experience. Remember that when we think of Maya, the prakriti includes both subject and object, right? Both seer and seen, hearer and heard. This is not when you, usually when you think of the world or the manifestation of the world, the manifestation of the creation, you don't include all of the jivas, all of the individuals. You think of the creation and then somehow the individuals came to be. But here, when we're looking at the creation, the individuals are included, the bodies, the sense organs, the mind, all subject and object. So there's everything that we know. Is it interesting, like right now from my vantage point, so you can all look at this from your vantage point, I know all of you, right? I know the room, I know all of the inert objects in the room, and I know all the sentient objects in the room also, know in the sense that you're all known to me, you're all perceived by me, right? But I often don't recognize that, well, actually, I know this body, the same sense organs that know all of you also are aware of this body. Also, my eyes and sense organs, they're also known to me, whether they're working or not. Those are also objectified. All of my thoughts and moods and emotions, they're also objectified. So in actuality, everything that is objectified falls under Maya. Consciousness, which is the ultimate subject, does not fall under Maya, right? Prakriti. Anything that can be known falls under prakriti, and that includes the body, mind, sense organs, which we usually don't think of it like that. But think about it like in terms of your dream. The dream is such an Achilles heel for understanding the reality of this creation. When you think of it, when you have a dream, the subjects and objects are included in the dream. Right? You are identified with the character in the dream. And you have friends and enemies and whatnot in the dream. You have animals and plants. And a whole dream world. But in that dream, both subjects and objects are included. But me, the consciousness, is really the self, not only of the subjects, the individuals in the dream, the knowers in the dream, the perceivers in the dream, the jivas, the self is the subject of the objects. So, in fact, the purusha has to be recognized, this conscious me, has to be recognized as both the self of the subjects, or the subject, if you're identified with the subject in the dream, and the self of the object. Because the dream comes from me. The Maya is that which projects. So the Maya is what is responsible for the whole manifestation of duality, and I am the consciousness which it enjoys. I am the sat-chit. The whole dream is known, and the whole dream is, but not in its own right, because the dream comes into manifestation and goes out of manifestation. I remain. So I'm the sat-chit of the dream. I'm the sat-chit, the conscious being of this. It's the same thing. I am the self of this body, mind, sense organs, and I am the self of all things known. There is nothing in this experience of mine that does not enjoy sat-chit, conscious being. We don't think of it like that because we only think of me as the conscious being. I, me, in this body, mind, sense organs, I am the conscious being And I'm looking out at all these names and forms, and there's some other conscious beings over there. But I don't recognize, you know, until I do, that actually all of these other conscious beings are in the same predicament as I am. That for each one of you, your body, mind, sense organs are objectifiable just as everything that is external to the body, mind, sense organs. So from your standpoint also, the conscious being that you are, is the conscious being itself, is the only thing which is non-objectifiable, but is self-evident, because consciousness is self-evident. Right? You don't need to bring in another consciousness to light up consciousness. But this conscious me that I am is self-evident me. And in reference to this manifest creation, the entire creation in my experience, just as a jiva now, enjoys me in terms of my being, my amness. As long as it is here, it is. You know? When it's not, I still am. Right? The amness is, but the objects come and go. Just like in the dream, everything goes on changing, but the amness, the being, remains. So here, the being, the me, is the being that all of this enjoys while it is here. And the knownness which all of it enjoys, where does that come from? That knownness is inviolate. The sat-chit, your experience, is inviolate in terms of your the conscious being, the knownness and the existence that all things enjoy. That never changes. It doesn't ever waver in any way at all. It's the constant. The experiences come objectifiable maya. Those experiences keep coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. At some point, when you recognize that the conscious being, the purusha, you recognize the purusha, the me, that is non-objectifiable and really is enjoyed by the whole prakriti, and you recognize that purusha as me, and you recognize the body, mind, sense organs, the ahankara, the I thought, all objectifiable experiences that are external to the body and contained and internal to the body. When I say internal, I mean your mind, your emotions, the I thought, experiences that you have as a jiva. When you recognize all of those things are also known, they're objectifiable, they belong to the prakriti, right? To maya. So when this viveka, when this differentiation is clear to you, where you can differentiate your being from the maya upadi, in the whole manifest creation, then even though you are engaged in this world, because here is a jiva, right? You could be, what they're actually meaning here, you could be in any stage. You could be a sannyasi, could be a renunciate, you could be practicing karma yoga, you know, you could be a householder, you could be engaged in any walk of life, in any type of activity. There's a famous story about Janaka, who was a famous king who had gained knowledge. So he was a jnani, a mahatma, and at the same time having knowledge, he ruling a kingdom. You can be a householder, have all kinds of, children, and children running around. And all kinds of household responsibilities. You could be a karma yogi. You can be anyone in any stage of life. That's sarvata means in any manner. Sarva means all. Ta means in any number of ways. You are existing here, being here, vartamana, means being here in any number of ways, with any number of responsibilities. You could be a sannyasi, or you could be a householder, you could be a brahmachari, you could be anything, But if you have gained this knowledge in this manner, he who knows, yaha evam veti, he who knows in this manner, as Krishna has been unfolding in this Upanishad, in this Bhagavad Gita, and in this chapter 13 in terms of purusha and prakriti, also in chapter 7 he did. If this is clear for the one who has that jnana nishtha, that clarity, no matter what responsibilities or what is going on here in this lifetime, he says, that person, when the body drops, when the prarabdha karma is over, that person is not reborn. That person doesn't take birth again. And so you say, well, what happens? So, a couple of things here. This jiva, means this transmigrating individual that takes birth after birth after birth, as the Shastra tells us, the Upanishad tells us, from beginningless time. There's no first birth, it's beginningless. This cyclical birth, death, taking birth after birth after birth, comes to an end only when one gains self-knowledge. There's so many verses in the Shruti that say this. He says so many. He's like Shiyante Chasya Karmani. I think that's from the Mandukya, the Mundaka. For him, you know, for that one who has knowledge, all of the karmas are destroyed. All of the karmas are destroyed. Another one. Brahma Veda Brahmaiva Bhavati. The one who knows Brahman, that one becomes Brahman. That one always is Brahman. Brahman means the self which is infinite. It means the non-dual self which is the truth of the whole creation, the changeless non-dual being that you are. The one who knows Brahman becomes Brahman. But what they mean by that is not that all of a sudden you've transformed yourself into Brahman. It's that for a jiva, individual, until you gain self-knowledge, you take your being, the conscious being, the me, this very personal being that you have totally, totally identified with the body, mind, sense organs. You take yourself to be this body, mind, sense organs, and if you're a Hindu, or really born in the East, you would absolutely take for granted that this body is one of many and that you're transmigrating. So you would take yourself, you would be certain that yourself, your being, is the subtle body that's transmigrating. And that's who you are. And so I have myself, you have yourself, we are individual selves. And now we're in this body, and this body is subject to death, but because of Shraddha, because of my faith in the Vedas and my upbringing, I just assume, take for granted actually, that I will take another body and then another body and another body. That's my identity. But upon gaining knowledge, with the knowledge that the Upanishads have to give, which is also part of the Vedas, right? It's the last part of the Vedas, the Upanishads. Those Upanishads reveal to me in their teaching methodology that this conscious being, this me that I am, is actually not transmigrating. In fact, it's never transmigrated, but is rather the self, the conscious being, that is the truth of the whole creation. And so that infinite being that I've taken to be limited by my body, mind, sense organs, I recognize that this, what I've taken to be a limited me, is actually Brahman, is actually the very self of Ishvara, the self of all beings, the self of the whole creation. So here he says, Brahma Veda Brahmaiva Bhavati, the one who knows Brahman, that one becomes Brahman. Finite cannot become infinite. What is finite and what is limited by time and space can never become infinite. So for you to become Brahman is to recognize that you are Brahman. And so Brahman is free of any type of change or any type of reincarnation or being Brahman. Brahman has never been born. The conscious being that you are is the conscious being that you are. There's no time. Your being is timeless. So the me that you are right now, if you think of the from the standpoint of the creation, if you go back hundreds of millions of years, however far it goes back, the me that was present to that creation of millions of years ago is the me that is present right now. It's not that I'm 100 million years old. Right? It's that the me is free of time. Consciousness is free of time. It's not objectifiable. So I'm not subject. Consciousness is not subject to age. It's not moody. It's not subject to any type of of change or modification, because it is not objectifiable. It doesn't exist as an object within time and space. So the me that I am is inviolate. Nobody, not even Ishvara, can do anything about it. Even God can't do anything about it, because it's God's self also. Right? The self of Ishvara, the non-objectifiable me, is the very self of Ishvara. So it's inviolate for Ishvara also. Inviolate means nothing can happen. Nothing can be done. Nothing can touch me or stain me or hurt me in any way. And so the being that I am, this very personal me, is something which can be trusted. Nothing in samsara can be trusted. Nothing can be trusted in this sense. You know, even how saintly or how wonderful a person is or how beautiful a situation is, it's still subject to change. You know, that's the nature of the creation. And so it's not trustworthy in that way. Even the most benign person is not trustworthy to whatever degree you need them. They can be trustworthy in their own beauty, in their own saintliness. But they can't be trustworthy in terms of giving you what you need, because they also exist within time and space, and they're also not attached to you. You know, that wonderful verse they have in tradition. So, you know, all of us are like two logs coming together in the ocean. You know, the waves of the ocean bring these two pieces of driftwood. They bring these two pieces of driftwood together, you know. And then the waves of the ocean hold them together for some time. They move these two pieces of driftwood, then they're moving through life together, right? For some time, until nature, you know, the nature of the waves, the nature of the wind, breaks them apart, and then they go their own way. For this short period of time, they enjoy some togetherness, you know? And they can be both so benign, so beautiful, and so kind, but that doesn't mean that they will continue staying together. The creation itself, by its nature, will pull everything apart. But... yeah, it's okay. pulls everything apart. That's the nature of the creation. It's the nature of the creation. But it's not the nature of the self. That whole creation that's, you know, in continual, perpetual motion is taking place in something which is changeless and timeless. And that is me. So that's the Purusha. The Prakriti is everything else, which includes everything else, includes your body, your mind, your sense organs, the sattva, it says, together with the three gunas. The sattva is the sense organs and the mind. Anything that reflects consciousness is the sattva of the Prakriti, right? Prakriti means that material cause for anything objectifiable, everything that exists within time and space, including time and space. So that which allows for the reflection or enjoyment of consciousness is sattva. Rajas is all of the activity. Tamas is the inertness of the names and forms. Now, another thing is that accounts for the experience of the creation in terms of sentiency, movement, you know, and name and form. But sattva, rajas, and tamas as gunas are also used as qualities, like qualities of the mind, for instance. A mind, your mind can be sometimes is predominantly sattva. When the mind is predominantly sattva, it means that rajas and tamas are these qualities of you could say agitation, rajas, agitation or tension or aggression. Those are rajas qualities. When sometimes those qualities are very much at bay and the mind is just enjoying sattva. No tamas either. Tamas would be like inertness, slovenliness, you know, dull-witted, you know, dull and kind of, yeah, stupid. All this is all tamas. Rajas can be very, very bright, but kind of in an aggressive, assertive type A personality way, you know. Can also be angry, anger and agitation, that's also rajas. And then sattva, the mind, is kind of like a clear, you know, a clear, placid lake that just reflects beautifully everything. It has no agitation. That mind is predominantly sattva. And so here, when we say the person who also understands the gunas, the nature of the gunas, you can understand rajas, that active principle, even in reference to what's going on in the creation, or sattva, what's going on in the creation, or tamas, in terms of darkness and dullness, what's going on in the creation, but also what's going on in your mind. Like, what if the mind is very rajasic, from rajas, rajasic? That means the mind has become, you know, it's very angry, it's very upset, it's very agitated. So Jnani would just say, that's rajas. That mind is rajasic. My mind is rajasic. Right. It's prakriti. The mind is prakriti. The body is prakriti. Sense organs are prakriti. The world is prakriti. So when my mind is acting in a rajasic way, then the mind is rajas. It's overwhelmed by rajas. When the mind is, you know, dull and slovenly and slogging, you know, hard to think and all of this, you know, or just tired and, you know, it's tamas. Oh, I'm so tamasic. We talk like that in India. I'm so tamasic in India. You know? I'm so rajas. I'm so rajasic. I've just got to do something. I'm so agitated. I'm so irritated. Or the mind is sattvic. And then say, oh, my mind is so peaceful and quiet. I wish it was always like this. I feel so full and complete, you know, because the mind is so quiet. Mm-hmm. So for Jnani, we want to have self-knowledge, that mind is sattvic. It's prakriti. So the prakriti is comprised of these three gunas. And so now the mind is very peaceful, it's very quiet, it's sattvic. It's the gunas, this, what is predominant there is sattva. Or what is predominant is rajas. Or what is predominant is tamas and rajas. That's kind of a dull agitation. So they combine them also. In fact, when we get to chapter 14, I think it gets into these gunas and talks like this. They said that there's some food is sattvic. Some food is very rajasic, like chilies. You know. Some food just makes you go to sleep when you eat it. You know, it just makes you tired. You know, some food, like fruits, keep you very alert. And, you know. Mm-hmm. So they go through all of these type of things. The point is, here is that for the one who has self-knowledge, everything is maya, prakriti. All of this body is prakriti, the sense organs are prakriti, the states of the mind is prakriti, it's objectified, it all belongs to maya, it's all part and parcel of Ishvara. And the gunas that are passing through, the sattva, the rajas and tamas, are those passing through the mind, passing through the body. That's what they are. There is no... For the one who has jnana nishtha, there's no one inside saying, oh, I have become rajas. If I say that, I'm irritated. Say a jnani, somebody who has knowledge, says, I'm very irritated. All they mean is their mind is irritated. You can't have knowledge and say, I, the Atma, have all of a sudden become irritated. It's not possible to say that. And I'm saying, once you've recognized yourself, Even theoretically, if you've studied and just have some book learning, you could never say that. But if you've recognized your own being, the me, the conscious being that can't be objectified, but is my very self, you are always the same. And so there's no ahankara there that is identifying your being with maya or with the gunas of maya. It can't happen. You can have a mind which is sattva, rajas, or tamas. You can have a body which is behaving in that way in terms of guna and quality. But you can't take your being to be that way, because your being is self-evident. And the ignorance that it caused you to identify with the body, mind, sense organs, and identify your ananda with the world, oh, I need this so I can be happy, that doesn't exist anymore. And so when this body drops, when the body dies, are you going to now become the body? Become the subtle body. You're not going to become the body because the body has died, but you're left with a subtle body. The subtle body is left when the body dies. But now, who is identified with it? Because even now, as a Jivan Mukta means one who's living liberated. Even now as a Jivan Mukta, one who has self-knowledge, you're not identified with it. The body is here enjoying you, but you're the Ahankara. The Ahankara is now not, is a Mithya Ahankara. Mithya means, I say like, I'm walking to the store. Well, Atma's not walking to the store. The body's walking to the store. I'm thinking, I'm reading, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. That's all mithya. Means it's as mithya as the body, mind, sense organs. It's maya. If I were to ask, say I said to you, because now I'm your teacher, so I said to you, oh, I just went to the store this afternoon, which I did actually. I just went to the store this afternoon. and I got some nice... fresh carrots, okay, which I did, okay, so I went to the store, I got some really nice carrots, okay. Mm-hmm. Then you say, oh, so now you're going to the store. I thought that the Atma didn't do anything, right? So you have to understand, if you have the Atma doesn't go to the store, you must not have knowledge because you said, I'm going to the store. And this comes in, you know, in Panchadashi in chapter 7, Vidyaranya, who's quite a character in some ways, he spends 3 or 4 verses on this. He says, when somebody who has knowledge says, I am going to the store, that what they mean is just that their body, you know, the body, mind, sense organs, this jiva complex is going to the store. Honestly, they don't mean that the Atma is going to the store. Whereas if a person who doesn't have knowledge says, I'm going to the store, then they do mean, absolutely, that this body, mind, sense organs is going to the store. So when a jnani says it, they are just talking in normal English language. Instead of saying the body is going to the store, you know, and the eyes are reading the book, or instead of talking in a strange way, they talk in a normal way, all the while knowing themselves that aham, the I, you know, is shining as their own self. That is aparoksha. Aparoksha means it is self-evident. My being is self-evident to me. All for every being. Your being is self-evident to you, with or without knowledge. It's self-evident experientially. Your own amness, the conscious being, the me, is self-evident. You don't need a pramana. You don't need a means of knowledge for that. Because consciousness is self-shining. So you are all of every being, even animals, plants, any being that has a sukshma sharira, a subtle body. That me, the me, is self-evident. But self-evident experientially, at the same time as being self-evident, it's totally identified with the body, mind, sense organs. The self is self-evident. It's going to be the same when you get with knowledge and with ignorance and with knowledge, you are exactly the same. But without knowledge, there's the superimposition of your body, mind, sense organs. So like a red-hot iron ball, you know, if you don't know the fire and the iron, it looks like it's seen is taken to be one entity. You take your being to be one with the body, mind, sense organs. It's still your being, still the self-evident me. For the jnani, the one who has self-knowledge, there's a viveka, there's a discrimination between the prakriti and you. The you is the same. But one has, because of ajnanam, because of ignorance, is superimposed the prakriti along with the gunas onto the self, and the self onto the gunas, onto the prakriti. The jnani doesn't make that mistake. So your self-evident being is known per se. Per se means as it is, as you are. So now, when the jiva, which is normally reincarnating. Why? Because there is a jiva. Jiva means ajnanam. There's ajnanam, ignorance covering yourself. And so the ahankara, you know, the I notion, is there very much identified with this body, mind, sense organs, and with all of the karmas that you've accrued. But when that ignorance is gone, when the body drops, then where is there any self to take up that position of the reincarnating jiva? It doesn't exist. It already doesn't exist right now. And so what they say is like this. The prarabdha karma, the karmas that have caused you to take this birth, that will take you through to the end of your life, so that the life story from your birth to your death, once you take this body, little baby, or is born, right? You are now, this body, mind, sense, organs is now in empirical reality. It's not subjective reality, it's empirical reality. It's now part and parcel of Ishwara. And it will live out its karma. So you get, when you get knowledge now, this body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishwara. And so the knowledge is not going to make this body, mind, sense organs go away as a subjective projection, like for instance, rope, snake. If I gain knowledge of the rope, the snake would go away because the snake is my subjective projection of my mind. This physical body is no longer, once it's now that it's been born into this empirical creation, it's not the subjective projection of my mind. And so when I gain knowledge, the body doesn't drop off like the snake does. The body will continue on until the prarabdha is over. But once the prarabdha is over, what is there in the internal structure of the subtle body of the sukshma sharira that would allow for any continuation? Because the ajnanam, the ignorance that had caused that anyonya adhyasa, that superimposition, is not there. You know? And so whatever karmas that were in the sanchitta file, means all the karmas that from beginningless time you have accrued, all of those karmas have to just go back into the elements because there's no karta. Karta means there's no doer. There's only the self. There's no doer. There's no ajnanam there to create that relationship between the prakriti and the purusha. It's not possible. And so the sanchitta karmas go away. And also then the question comes, well, what about the karmas that you've accrued here in this life? How are those going to go away? Because those also haven't been exhausted. It's the same thing. There's no karta. There's no doer. There's no ahankara. And so there's no one to hook the karmas onto. It's exactly like it is for you, for one who has knowledge right now. Even though you have this body, mind, sense organs, there is no one to hook the karmas onto because consciousness is not objectifiable. It's not subject to change. It doesn't have any parts. It's never been subject, it's never had any karmas. It can't have any karmas and it never will have any karmas. So yourself has never at any time had karmas. The karmas are only belong to the subtle body and taking body after body after body. You see that? Because awareness, consciousness, doesn't have any parts. It's not a knower. It doesn't have a mind. It doesn't have sense organs. It doesn't have organs of action. All of these, what we call conditioning adjuncts or upadis, depend on the upadi being there. Like this body, to make this a little bit more clear, this body has me, consciousness, for itself. It's not like consciousness is out here somewhere and the body is out here. This body enjoys consciousness. But consciousness is free of the body. The sense organs enjoy consciousness. But consciousness is free of the sense organs. As the sense organs are there, they enjoy consciousness. But consciousness illumines those sense organs. It's a different order of reality. I'm a different order of reality than the things which are enjoying me. It's kind of like You can understand what I mean by order of reality when you think of the dream. The dream totally enjoys your being, right? Everything, the entire dream and every individual in the dream, plus the whole dream creation, enjoys your being, the Satchit. But the Satchit, conscious being that you are, is not involved in the dream. The dream has no being apart from you, but your being is not involved in the dream. You as a character in the dream are involved, but not the me, not the conscious being, the one from whom the dream comes. That's a, so the dream is a different order of reality that is totally dependent upon me for its being. The snake is a different order of reality than the rope. The snake needs the rope. You know, it can't be without the rope. The rope is its sat, is its being, right? So, but the rope doesn't need the snake. The rope is satyam in reference to the snake. The rope is real, the snake is subjective, apparent, dependent. The rope is satyam, the snake is mithya. Mithya, the rope is the adhishtana, means that which is necessary in order for the snake to be. But the rope doesn't need the snake. Like that, the me is inviolate. I'm not an objectifiable. Nothing ever happens to me. I'm a different order of reality. This order of reality within this creation, subjective and object, this is the object of creation that I experience through my sense organs. Everything in this creation is coming into being and going out of being. It's not inviolate. It's subject to death. Change is death. Change is the death of the prior moment. And those moments are infinitely divisible. And the way you can just be kind of negative and say, there's just nothing but massive death here. Just a massive death, because every moment is a death of the prior moment. You can say positively, there's just massive birth here. Because the death of one moment is the birth of the next. You know? So we can say it is an infinite display of infinite change that you can't get to the bottom of. Change is continually divisible. But all of this is taking place, and all of it is objectifiable. All of this is enjoying a Satchit conscious being, which is not objectifiable. The Satchit is changeless. Being is changeless. It's not an object in the creation, it's the self of the creation, the adhishtana, what the actual the creation depends upon. I am a combination, in terms of I think of the whole jiva, of the sat. The sat is the me that is non-negotiable, that cannot be objectified, this I, not the word I, but the being me. And all of this change, the body which is changing, the mind that is changing, the ahankar, the I that is changing, the memories that are changing, the whole experience. I'm a combination. When I say I am a combination, that's like saying I'm a red-hot iron ball. The combination is the conscious being, which is myself, and the prakriti, which is experienced. But because of ajnanam, there's this, sometimes Swamiji calls this unholy alliance. You know? Because actually there's no possibility for non-objectifiable, changeless consciousness to come into any type of relationship with something that is objectifiable, objectified, and subject to continual change. The only reason there is a relationship is because this mithya, this maya is mithya. It doesn't have any substance or being apart from consciousness. Just like the relationship between you and your dream. The dream is not anything separate from you because it has no being apart from you, but it comes and goes in being. And so it's a different order of reality. Well, this whole creation is a different order of reality from me, Vyavaharaka Satyam. It's empirical reality, it's Ishwara, but it is a different order of reality than what is actual conscious being. Satyam. Satyam is that which can never be negated, never subject to any type of change or death. It's that which exists in all three periods of time. It can never be negated. The only thing that is like that is consciousness, something that doesn't exist as an object within duality, but is the very underlying adhishthana self of all duality. So now, this order of being that is mitya, like the dream, is a different order of reality from me. Now, me has never transmigrated, has never been born, will never be born, can never be born, is timeless. And so when this jiva, which has for its adhishtana, its very truth, only me, when this jiva gains self-knowledge, then what allows that jiva entity to be isn't there anymore. There's no ajnanam. And so I have myself back, and so what am I now when this body drops? I am Ishvara. I am Brahman, just the conscious being that I've always been. And I have this magical maya, this maya which is an incidental attribute of my being. We say incidental attribute because it brings about no change to my being. It's a different order of reality. And so that's who I am, and in fact, that's who I've always been. I've never been a jiva from my standpoint, from the standpoint of me, of consciousness. I've never been a jiva. I've only been a jiva and only been Ishvara from the jiva standpoint or Ishvara standpoint. But for the self, there's never even any ajnanam. So when that ignorance is removed from the jiva, then there's only me. And when this body drops, all of the karmas that were accrued in this magical land of the creation go back to the creation. It's kind of like, to really get it, in the dream, the jivas in those dreams are doing all kinds of actions. They can get into all kinds of trouble. They can do all kinds of adharma. They can do saintly deeds. They can do all kinds of things in the dream. When you wake up from the dream, all those karmas are gone. They all went with the dream. Right? They belong to the dream characters. They did not belong to you. They never belong to you. And so when you wake up from this dream, this vyavahara, this empirical reality, the body drops, the prarabdha is gone, there is no karma for you. You are Brahman, and Brahman has never had any karma. So for you, there's no transmigration. So the Shruti backs that up, and also any type of logic backs that up also. But in the end, you have to rely on the Shruti, because you would rely on, Shruti means the Upanishads, the Vedas. Because why would you even believe in reincarnation in the first place? You have no way to have that knowledge. You can intuit it, you can believe in it. The Shastra says that it's true, that the jiva transmigrates from beginningless time. You know, so what they consider this revealed scriptural text attests to it throughout the Shruti. And based upon your understanding of the Shruti and your understanding of your own being, it makes sense. Right? But even to some of these things to accept, like reincarnation, you believe it because you believe it. Right? You have something, you have that shraddha, in maybe in the scripture, or you brought it with you and from your last life. You that's what works for you and what you believe, and that belief is something that's contained in the Vedas and substantiated by the Vedas. The same Vedas that say there is this reincarnation say that when a person gains self-knowledge, that transmigration of the jiva comes to an end. And then gives all that logic for it. Yeah. I think for many of us, we don't even think twice about the transmigration of the jiva. It seems just, it's we accept it. It's almost like many of us have, for whatever reason, I mean, in India it makes sense, but I know many Westerners also just accept it. Because it just intuitively works in so many levels. Mm. And, you know, I've been teaching at CIS for many years now, and some of the classes, I teach some Vedanta classes, and I teach some spiritual counseling. And often I'll, at the very big first class, I'll ask, like, moksha for the little.
Oh, I'm not supposed to do that.
No, it's okay. You just liberated a little.
Oh, no.
I'll ask the students, you know, how many people, you know, believe in the transmigration of the soul, or the incarnation. I've been doing this for years, just because it's appropriate for the class, also it's not out there or anything. They almost, I'd say, like 99% just raise their hand.
Wow.
Yeah. Of course, that's part California, too, in San Francisco. But, you know, it's something that, it's an understanding that resonates with people. It's hard to even imagine or to make sense out of the universe or the world to think that you just were born and you die. You know, and this is your only shot here. This is your only chance. And then if you are religious, you know, in the kind of the Christian world, then you'll go to heaven or hell or purgatory. But you only had this one chance. And it's short, and other people get a lot better opportunities than you do, and then some people get really worse opportunities for no reason. No reason. No karma, because there's no prior condition. It's just the luck of the draw, you know, and then you die, and that's it. Well, that doesn't sit very well. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. There's nothing that feels true about that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it doesn't resonate.
It doesn't resonate. There's reasons, we can't get into it now because it's too late, our time is gone, but there's reasons for it not resonating. And one major reason is that it is literally impossible for you to imagine your own non-existence. It's impossible, it's an impossible feat. And the reason that it is an impossible feat is that in any imagination, even if you try to black out everything, totally, what is filling it is being. Being will always fill non-being. And so you can never have the experience. Because such a conscious being, right, is of a different order of reality than the mind and the sense organs and all this. So whatever the mind does, it can't do anything about its adhishtana. It's like, just imagine the snake on a rope trying to imagine the non-existence of the rope when the only thing that is there is the rope. Yeah. So you can't get there, no matter how black you make, or dark or empty you make the situation, you are filling it. And so it's impossible to imagine. You can imagine your body not being there, your mind not being there, all of these things you can imagine, but you can never wipe out your being. It's very interesting. In fact, it's a very good guided meditation to try to eliminate existence. You will eliminate all the existence that you can, all objectifiable things. It's good meditation because you're just left with me, with being. And then you can keep trying to eliminate that, try to eliminate the being. And all that will happen is the beingness becomes more and more pure. So, anyway, let's stop there. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
There's a few things that are glomming together that mm-hmm. are confusing, and let me see how far I can go correctly. It's the jiva that transmigrates, not the karya, karana, sangata.
The jiva is the karya. Well, when we say
it is the karya sangata with anyonya abhyasa.
When we say really karya karana sangata, that's including the karana would be the sense organs and mind, the sukshma sharira, the karya, the effect would be the physical body. So when we say that, we're talking about the body-mind complex. So when we talk about the one that transmigrates, right, the physical body, you take physical body after physical body, so the physical body's not transmigrating. That's going to be the body that you take in the particular loka, or sphere, world you find yourself in. So the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, is what transmigrates. Okay?
And but it's only a sukshma sharira that is subject to anyanya adhyasa.
Because remember, if we say anyanya adhyasa, which means mutual superimposition, that requires ajnanam, ignorance. Right? That requires ignorance. And so when we're talking about mutual superimposition, now, when you have a sukshma, you have ignorance, and now even here, say you don't have ignorance, you have self-knowledge now, but this is already an empirical reality. So that, in a sense, that mutual superimposition is there, even though you can differentiate the subject from the self from the object. This body is here, so it enjoys consciousness, right? The sense organs enjoy consciousness. But it's a satya-mitya relationship where the body-mind-sense organs are mitya, means totally dependent upon consciousness for their being. That's all very, for Jnani, that one of self-knowledge, that's all very, very clear. Right? So when we say, so to get back to this, when we say anyonya adhyasa, mutual superimposition, that brought about by ajnanam, right? That mutual superimposition for a jnani is not there anymore.
And the body wouldn't be here if the ignorance hadn't been there, the mistake hadn't been there.
Once the ignorance is gone, the body will be here until it runs out of its current, the karmas that made it be part of this empirical reality, because this body at this point isn't your projection, right? You can't say, oh, I have knowledge, so body disappear. Right, this body is part of Ishwara now, it's part of empirical reality. And so when this body dies, now the sukshma sharira, there's no ajnanam there to hold it together, because it's not now being part of empirical reality.
Does it hold together even after knowledge? Or does it wait? At death it no longer holds together?
Only at death. Because once it's taken this body, it's combined with this physical body. Mm-hmm. Right? As long as this physical body is alive, the sukshma sharira is knotted, in a way, to the physical body.
But the body also, it's kind of like living proof that you were ignorant, that you are a jiva and you were...
You were ignorant.
Yeah.
Did not have self-knowledge or you wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have taken this birth.
Yeah.
Though there are some in the Brahma Sutras, there are a couple of, there's one sutra actually that talks about an extenuating circumstance for some reason. I have to go and reread this. There can be your prarabdha can extend more than one lifetime.
Yeah.
They do talk about that in the Brahma Sutras, but that's an exception. Mm. I don't remember.
The self, even for someone who's ignorant, is actually never subject to karma. It just...
And never subject to ignorance. That's right. The self is always the same. It's the same in all beings. You know, it's the self of the creation. It's the same when the creation is present and when the creation is absent. There's no ever any change for conscious being. Conscious being is what we call the adhishtana. It's that which actually is, and gives its being to whatever is the maya. Maya is the whole manifest creation. So I say two orders of reality. I think it's helpful to understand the difference, like the two orders of reality. When there's two orders of reality, the one order of reality, like the snake, never can touch the rope. What can it do to touch the rope? Nothing. You know, even if you use clay pot, how can the pot touch the clay? It's not there. The only thing that's really there is clay. There's nothing that the pot, even if the pot becomes very intricate or you make it into a plate, it has no capacity to touch the clay because the only thing there is clay. You see what I'm saying? It's not like there's a pot that's laying on top of it touching it. And so it's a different order of reality. The pot is mithya, the clay is satyam. The snake is mithya, the rope is satyam. The self is satyam. This body, mind, sense organs, which depend on it for its being, are mithya. To really think of the dream is mithya, the self is satyam. The dream characters are mithya, the self is satyam.
That takes a lot of teaching, because the body and the mind, they don't say they're mithya. They say they're satyam.
You can't even use the word mithya correctly without understanding satyam. Mm-hmm. In other words, if I were to just tell you that the pot of the clay, the pot is mithya, that has no meaning at all. Mithya is only meaningful in reference to satyam. So without understanding the clay, you can't say the pot is mithya. So we can't say this creation is mithya at all without having taught what is its satyam, because the word is not meaningful. It's only meaningful in reference to what we call its adhishtana. The adhishtana is that which actually is there. It's a different order of reality. Right?
Now, this
and this order of reality,
okay,
is this has for itself that word is satyam, right? But can't touch it because it has no being apart from satyam. How can the dream, you know, touch the waking state or the self of the dream? How can the imagination touch the conscious being from whom the imagination comes?
So, I don't know if I'm following that exactly. So is what you're talking about mean that one's existence is already preordained in a sense?
I would say not preordained.
That, yeah.
One's existence is timeless. So the self that you are, when you think just me, this very personal self, that personal conscious being that you are has been, because of beginningless ignorance, really, of your mind, identifies that being with you, as though when your mind is happy, you are happy. When your mind is sad, you are sad. So there's no differentiation that's been made between that self, me, and these experiences that are objectifiable. But what is the Upanishad is pointing to is that for you to recognize that this conscious being that you are is changeless. It's timeless. Even in terms, first you have to recognize it in terms of your experience right here and now. That the you, the conscious being that you are, is the constant. Like, I am the one that was here 5 minutes ago, or the last thought, and the present thought, and then the future thought. The thoughts negate each other, right? But they don't negate me. I'm the self of all of the thoughts. I'm the self who is here in this waking state, and this very self that's here in the waking state is the one here in the dream state. And that self is the one there in the deep sleep state. Those states negate each other. But I am the self of all three. Then you can say, the self, that the me that is here right now, is the one that was here yesterday. Yesterday isn't here now. It's gone. The me that is here right now is the same self that was a little girl. Right? Mm-hmm. The same self that will be the old person that will say, I am the same person and here I am stuck in this old body. You know, the old people say that. You know, mm-hmm. my mother said it.
Mm-hmm.
This body is, I'm just, honey, mm-hmm. I'm the same.
Yeah.
The same person. And when I look in the mirror, I can't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
That Atma is the same. It never goes through any change. So that needs, that's you. And it has to be differentiated, which what the teaching helps you to see it, mm-hmm. that you, in fact, are the constant. You never change. Never. You can recognize your being as the one who is happy, who is sad, who is agitated. These states negate each other. Right? The sad person is not the happy person. Mm-hmm. The agitated person is not the calm person. But I'm all of them. So if I'm all of them, I can't be any of them. Because if I was any of them, when one went away, I would go away. So I have to discern now who stays. What in my experience that this me, who is the one that is always here? And you say, well, the one that is always here is me. Even, you know, most of us have some sort of meditative practice. You absorb your mind, you know, withdraw your sense organs, and maybe you just sit watching your thoughts and quiet your thoughts, quietening all your experiences. And who's always left? It's always me. The one I can't get rid of. And that one who I can never get rid of is me.
Yeah. And how do you go about trying to get rid of that, to see that it won't, you can't get rid of it?
You don't really have to get rid of it. What you can do is because there's a logic that is kind of a non-negatable logic. The logic is this. If something comes into being and goes out of being, and I'm still there, then I'm not that. That's called anvayavyatireka. For me to actually be something, then when that something is there, I am there. When that something is gone, I'm gone. Then I have an identity with that thing. But if that something is there, and I'm there, and that something goes, and I'm still here, there's no identity. Because I can be without it. Okay, so you can notice in your own experience, sometimes you have to sit quietly and slow down your mind a little bit, just so that you can be aware of this. That's why we do so many guided meditations, you know, to help be able to really recognize this. But all of these experiences are coming and going in me. I'm not coming and going.
That's so interesting when you think of attachment in psychology.
How so, you mean? We do get very
I was thinking more of an infant or child. I mean, that kind of, I can't think of the word, like primal
attachment.
Or need.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine, like, even for an infant, the infant is the body, mind, sense organs, little baby, okay?
Yeah.
That little baby is the mitya. It enjoys conscious being. The mind is never away from conscious being. So why shouldn't the mind and the subtle body is feeling the physical body? So why shouldn't that mind say, that this is what we mean by beginningless ignorance, mm-hmm. I am,
mm-hmm.
you know, even without words, I am this body-mind. Mm-hmm. What else will it say?
Yeah.
You know? So what has to happen is when the person becomes an adult and also wants knowledge, not everybody wants it. A lot of people don't even think about it. But if you want to know, then you need some sort of means of knowledge, such as the Upanishads, that have a teaching methodology to help you understand, to make this differentiation between your being, you know, and the experiences that you're having. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because usually it's like a red hot iron ball. It's all just one entity. Mm-hmm. And there's no discrimination there. Yeah.
Now this mutual
Superimposition.
What's the mutual component of that?
Anyonya. Oh, you mean what is it talking about?
Yeah, what is it actually referring to?
From the standpoint of consciousness, consciousness takes on the qualities of the mind and the body. So then consciousness becomes finite, subject to birth and death, and moody.
I see.
Whatever the qualities are, consciousness gains those qualities.
Okay.
And the mind and the body and sense organs gain consciousness. They become the conscious entity. Right? So this body, mind, sense organs becomes the conscious entity, and consciousness gains all the qualities of the body, mind, sense organs. So that's the mutuality.
How can consciousness ever... like
not from its own standpoint.
Yeah, you mean just in a relative way, how we experience it within ourselves.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
With the mind, yeah. Well, from the standpoint of consciousness, there's no problem.
Yeah.
Consciousness, that's why you are, fortunately, because you are liberated. If you weren't by nature liberated, you would be an object in the creation subject to birth and death and change that the creation is subject to. Right? There's no getting away from that. If you are, like, it's like asking this body, you know, to become changeless. There is nothing in the body, the mind, the sense organs, and your experience that is free from change. So there's no constant. The self is the constant. Because there is a constant, the constant is the truth of the whole thing. And so that holds the whole thing together. And because really, the reality is constant being, timeless being. But all of this mitya, this names and forms and all of this change, has for its adhishtana, for its reality, changeless conscious being. Me. You have to always say me, because if you don't, it becomes like some abstract conscious being, you know. Mm-hmm. We're talking about really you, the innermost me that makes you you, the one that you identify right now with as being you. It's just you've taken this very personal you that you take to be you. You lock the body onto that and the mind and the sense organs. You don't realize that this you is the self of the body, mind, sense organs, and is also free of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why sometimes using this, understanding this different order of reality is helpful. Or it can be too abstract also. Just depends. Yeah.
Use what works.
You see, it's interesting what you said, that there can never be trust in the finite, you know? Or you said, like, into the infinite is... No, trust into the finite is not possible. So it's always like... It seems like on the relative, in the body-mind is looking for this trust in this body-mind experience. But
it's never really getting
a home run on it, because everything is constantly in change.
Yeah.
And nothing is really...
You can trust it if you don't ask anything of it. If you appreciate it as Ishwara,
yeah,
you know, and you don't ask it to be any way other than what it is,
right,
so then that's fine.
Well, that's beautiful, yeah.
But when you're asking it
mm-hmm.
to be something that it cannot be, then, of course, you'll be hurt by that, because you're asking the impossible. You know?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because psychologically, also, if you think about that, that's just so, that goes so deep.
What would that look like, to ask the body to be something it's not? The body-mind complex.
well,
be
say
something
you,
that's not. What
well,
that
say
like?
Say you don't want. You only want one type of thought in your mind. You know, or say you want to live forever. You know, say you want your body to. You never want your body to get sick. You want it to live forever. You want your mind to be in continually sattvic. These are big problems, actually.
Yeah.
You know, like the pressure you put, unrealistic pressure you put on the mind to be have only certain types of thoughts. It's absolutely not real, not realistic, not even possible. That's a biggie, you know.
Because it's always supposed to be bright.
Or be bright, or be saintly, or only have positive thoughts, never have any weird thing coming through. Any non-saintly thoughts, you know. All these things, all impossibilities. Or to think that your mind should not think. The mind should just abide stilly. It should not think. That's not the mind. The mind has to think. It has to engage. Every time you open your eyes, the mind is engaged. If the mind wasn't engaged with your sense organs, then your sense organs wouldn't be working. You'd be daydreaming or something. You know, so the mind is an instrument that is continually engaged, continually taking in tons of data, way more than your conscious mind could ever assimilate. It's just pouring into the unconscious. It's all pouring in, but it's going through incredible filters because we couldn't negotiate in the world without filters. You know, so a lot is coming in, it's all being stored here and there. A lot is coming out. Even in thought flow, a lot of, you know, what comes in will come out. And so we make a lot of demands on our body, on our mind, on our ways of thinking, all of these things, and on others that are not real. They're not realistic. And then we react when what could never be isn't happening. Mm-hmm. What it actually could never be is not happening. And we get upset. So that's...
Are you saying my tantrums are unjustified?
I'm saying they're completely justified because of that ajnana. You know. And then we'll work on our tantrums. The whole mess has to unwind. There's layers and layers and levels and levels and levels of ajnana, of ignorance, you know. It's not just one layer. The whole life.
It's a matrix.
It's a matrix, yeah. So all of that has to unwind over time, and as it unwinds, more and more you appreciate Ishvara. You know, you appreciate this creation as it is, because less and less are you asking the impossible from it. Mm-hmm. When you don't ask the impossible from it, you can actually, you know, enjoy what is here, because you're not asking for what it can't give you.
Well, sometimes,
and when you ask for what it can't give you, you also feel stressed because you know that it really can't give you that.
Well,
and
then,
so you're just,
you know,
pretending, really.
That's something where you have to be very careful in your prayers, because you can ask for something that can't happen.
Well, that's true. That's why they say, you know, when you pray, you should say, Bhagavan, you know, if it's in my best interest.
Mm-hmm.
If you think that this is good for all beings, for me and for all beings, I would like this.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with prayer, but you should always say, I know you know best. That's kind of saying, I know you know best,
okay.
But,
yeah.
You know, if I could just have this, I think it would really be fun, and I wish you would give it to me. But you have to do all that tongue-in-cheek in a way.
You have to do what?
Tongue-in-cheek. You should know that actually what is best you're getting. You know, there's a certain shraddha in that.
But prayers can be efficacious as well, because if like you're praying for somebody's good health,
yeah,
like for Swamiji, you know?
That's true. Prayers are a karma. They're considered a manasa karma that's taking place in the mind. They're a karma. And so when you pray, like for somebody's well-being, you should count those, you should take those prayers seriously. It's an action that is involving your will. It's not just like thought flow. It's an action. And so that those actions have results. So I actually take prayer very seriously. Scientifically, they've done a lot of studies on prayer also, and they have quite a bit of data now showing that it is efficacious. Mm-hmm. It does help. You know? I think prayer is a really beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered, when you said like this, layers and layers of ignorance, I mean, it sounds a little bit, oh my God, so much ignorance. But there's also these moments where, you know, we talk about the pond where everything lifts.
And yes, it's totally clear.
And then it comes back. But so there is the complexity of the layers of ignorance, but then at moments it's also completely gone. It's
as though in a certain situation the reeds are opened. Mm-hmm. But then in another situation they close. And so all that means is that in different areas, you know, that ignorance has not been eradicated. Swamiji once in a talk, he likened it to a big beam of light. You know, the teacher's like has this big beam of light and is following the ahankara, the ajnanam in the student, following it around. And the I notion is just, you know, scampering. I am a little individual. So this light of the teaching, you know, because the teaching is so thorough, it's just beaming at every little nook and cranny until finally the ahankara, the I notion goes, okay, uncle, cries uncle. And it has no place to go anymore. And then there's a huge relief, actually. Mm. It's a huge relief. Mm. Because yourself is always there. It's not. It's just that the ahankara, the I notion had, the ego, had taken this me to belong to something finite, and it doesn't. And so it's not like something really happens. Nothing really happens when you gain self-knowledge. You're still the you you've always been. It's just all of this trauma and, you know, imaginary problems that have been loaded on that I've been living with are not there anymore.
Yeah. But even, let's say, there's layers and layers of ignorance and it lifts sometimes, you know, you see here the clear pond and then closes. But then there's also the moment, I think, where the teachings talk about like something like grace, where it's just like at one point it might not close again.
Yeah, right.
Even there were many layers of ignorance. I mean, it's not really that we have to work through all these layers.
No.
Like it opens up and it closes at one point and that's not in our control.
That's right. The knowledge keeps the pond, at some point the pond stays open. You know, I tell the story that when I was going to classes in India in the 70s, was studying every day, we had class, you know. And I used to notice that, like, the pond would open, the reeds would all open during the class, and it was so wonderful. And, you know, I remember by the time I would get to the door, they would be closed. Mm. Again, and I remember thinking, and actually making a very, like a sankalpa, a very firm thought to remember this. And the thought was, someday I will make it all the way to my room, and that won't happen. Mm. And when I made it to my room, I remembered that, and I remember thinking, yes, I made it clear to my room. That's not happening anymore.
What wasn't happening?
Because the reeds closing over, like you're listening to the teaching and everything's so clear, and you're seeing it, and you're in an exalted state. What do you call that? A difference? What do you call that?
Altered
state. Yeah. Exalted,
yeah.
Also.
Yeah, we like
an
those.
Exalted, mm-hmm. Altered state. You're in an altered state, and then by the time you get to the door, you know, the whole samsara comes rushing back in.
Mm-hmm. So that would be the mutual superimposition, huh?
Well, this mutual superimposition is just in reference to that the firmness of that identity of consciousness with the body, mind, sense organs. But here, it's just that you've spent lifetimes, beginningless lifetimes, this body, mind, sense organs being identified, identifying the conscious being this body, mind, sense organs, and I'm a little unit, and you're a little unit, and we're making our way through this world. And we have the Vedas or whatever our scriptural authority is to make some container for us. But that's basically what I'm doing, and everyone else is also. See, it's not like I'm just the crazy one and everybody else is sane. It's that we're all crazy. I mean, we're all subject to the same delusion, to the same ignorance. And so, you know, we're contained together in this. And so once a person kind of breaks out of it and starts asking, well, what is really going on? And who am I? And why did I come here? The majority of people will feel kind of sorry for you.
Well, you can feel sorry for yourself, too, in that condition.
Like, like, what's wrong with this person, you know? Like my mom, when she said, oh, honey, I don't have those kind of problems. I was explaining it, talking to her about India when I got home from India, you know. She asked me a question, and I told her too much. I went into too much detail.
My dad would always say, you're thinking too much. Also.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, he was totally pathologizing.
Yeah.
Just inquiry, period.
Yeah.
Amazing, huh?
Yeah.
It was what? Pathologizing? What does that mean?
Pathologizing. Making it wrong.
What did you say earlier?
Pathologizing.
What does that mean?
Making it into an illness.
Oh, okay.
Pathology is like an illness.
Oh, pathological.
Yeah, pathological,
yeah. Yeah.
So pathologizing means, you know, you're telling me something and I'm taking what you're saying, you know, and turning it into and interpreting it as an illness.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but also like trying to make the point.
Yeah. No, I totally understand. Yeah, it's true.
Now, this mutual, the one thing that I still don't understand is like this mutual superimposition thing. In what context do we use that? Like, what are we trying to...
We're trying to show when we're using that, this anyonya adhyasa, to be, that's the result of self-ignorance.
Yeah.
Who has ignorance? Who is the one that has self-ignorance is the mind, okay?
Right.
So because of that self-ignorance, the mind takes itself to be the self.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mind gains conscious existent. I am a conscious existent mind. That's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And the consciousness and existence belong to me, the mind. Okay? And so the mind has gained conscious existence. And the self, which is really the satyam, the self gains the qualities of the mind. And so all we're doing there, when we're talking about that, is showing this, the red-hot iron ball condition that is brought about by self-ignorance. The red-hot iron ball condition between consciousness and the body-mind-sense organs. Where from the standpoint of the mind, the mind gains conscious being, and conscious being gains the qualities of the mind.
I think you should describe a little bit of that red-hot iron ball for people that may not
know. Oh, red-hot iron ball. Okay. I have fire on this side. We all know what fire is. Okay? At least we know. But, and you have a hot red, you have an iron ball. Here there's no anyonya adhyasa. There's no mutual superimposition. I've got fire here. And I've got an iron ball here. But if I were to heat the iron ball, what I would have is an iron ball that is red hot. And I would have fire that is round and heavy. At least
mm-hmm.
from the drishti, from the vision of an ignorant person.
Mm-hmm.
The ignorant person would be the one who doesn't know the nature of fire and doesn't know the nature of iron. And so seeing these two, the red-hot iron ball is to take them to be one entity, as though there is a round, heavy, hot ball. See what I mean? It's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand that fire belongs to fire and iron belongs to iron. And so here, this physical body and mind, you know, the body-mind complex, is taken to be conscious being. It is the conscious being. Right? So that's one side of the mutual superposition. And conscious being is taken to be the body. The body is taken to be the conscious being is taken to be the body. So conscious being, the me, now becomes finite, subject to birth and death and illness. I take myself to be the mind, so I'm subject to agitation and hurt and pleasure and pain. All the qualities, whatever the mind can do, you know, that's me doing it. And so I take on all of these qualities of the body and the mind, and the body-mind takes on me. The body-mind becomes the real conscious me, the I. And I take on all of its qualities. That's the anunya, mutual superimposition. It's like fire taking on the nature of iron, round, heavy ball. Fire takes that to itself. And round, heavy iron ball takes on brightness and heat. That belongs to the iron. That's the mutual superimposition. All caused by ignorance. What we call aviveka. Aviveka, the viveka means discrimination. Aviveka means lack of discrimination. So we say that self-knowledge requires viveka jnanam, viveka jnanam, discriminatory knowledge. Knowledge which is a discrimination. The discrimination is really between satyam and mitya, that which is the actual conscious being and that which is dependent upon it for its being. Oh, okay. We're done.